Previously on Beta.
The cursed mummy went by the name of Princess Amun-Ra, aka Shipwrecker.
Do you want to go to war, Malaki?
No.
Because we could go to war.
No.
I'm for real. I'm for real. So you better check yourself.
Is it congenital? Did your mother drop you on your head when you were a baby?
The buzzer did not buzz, and you were the one that made me move the keys in the first place, remember?
Yes, I see your point.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, The Ringer's Shay Serrano talks about his book, Movies and Other Things, where he ponders cinematic thought experiments like unfilmed scenes.
I would like to know, like, how that went. Was the guard just like, all right, cool? Did the warden have to lean on him a little bit? What was the interplay here? I like to think about stuff that we know for certain happened in a movie. It's fun to imagine those scenes.
Also, actor Folake Olowofoyeku on how immigrating to America led to her lead in the CBS sitcom Bob Hart's Abishola.
I just thought I was here on vacation, but something intuitively alerted me that it might be the start of a new chapter.
But first, singer-songwriter piano player Ben Folds. He's had a long, successful career as an unconventional icon. He's created genre-bending music throughout his solo work and as the frontman of the trio Ben Folds 5. Ben has released a memoir called A Dream About Lightning Bugs, A Life of Music and Cheap Lessons. I sat down with him backstage before a recent show in Madison. Ben talked about his life and career and why the early Ben Folds 5 sound was brutish.
Well, the idea was to not serve the song, because the songs had lives before Ben Folds 5, and they hadn't been successful. You know, like, I'd been playing those in little clubs by myself. I'd made demo tapes for years. It had all more or less been rejected. And we just kind of stumbled upon the power of just beating the songs up. I think in the book, I use the image of the suitcase commercial where the monkeys are beating up the suitcases. If they can stand that, then they're good suitcases. And that was their quality control. It's kind of like that with my songs. I mean, we turned the vocal down. The vocal was, I wasn't particularly, wasn't a grand singer trying to do everything that I could for the song necessarily. The distorted bass was louder sometimes than the vocal, and cymbals were bashing, and I was playing wrong notes. I mean, it was really pretty raucous stuff. But in the middle of it is a song that could be like a Broadway hit.
Mm.
So the idea was just like, let's put that kid in a rough neighborhood and let him get beat up some.
I'd like to tell you everything. 'Cause nothing changes, ever changes, doesn't seem the same.
As you write in your book, you know of no precedent for a full-time guitarless piano rock trio in the mainstream when Ben Folds 5 started. Do you think that was the band's USP, unique selling proposition?
Yes, definitely. We were the piano band that rocked, the piano band that would go play on a grunge stage, and that was a big part of it. You know, I dedicate a little time in the book to exploring the successful moments of piano rock prior to us. Emerson, Lincoln, Palmer is a good example, but most of the time that's organ. Most of the time that's distorted B3. Then when it's piano, the piano is greatly affected with, you know, all kinds of effects. And Elton John did that 11-17-70 album, which wasn't intended to be an album. It was just a live show. He would have preferred to have more players, but they were on a budget. They were doing their first U.S. tour. God, I think it brings out the incredible pianist in Elton. You know, like, that's some of his best piano playing. But yeah, so I felt like I could safely say that we were the ones that committed to it in the studio and everything. You know, we came along in an era where there seemed like everything had been done. Mm-hmm. And in a way, in rock and roll, maybe it kind of all had. I mean, rock is not the innovative force that it was. It's gone to R&B and that side of music.
Ben, at one point in your memoir, you describe yourself as a songwriting sociopath. What do you mean?
Did I say that?
Yeah, you did.
Sociopath. I think that I am often disconnected emotionally from what I'm writing, not on purpose, but just because my main mission is to write a great song. Randy Newman likes to say he would run over his grandmother for a song. And I like to say that I would run over Randy Newman's grandmother for a song, too.
I thought you were just going to say I would run over Randy Newman for a good song.
I'd run over his grandmother for a song, too. I'd save Randy Newman for a couple more songs, at least. But no. So what I probably meant out of that was probably a lot of conditions that exist in someone who is not emotionally attached would exist in a lot of songwriters and a lot of story writers. Mm-hmm. Because you're putting the lab coat on and you're writing the best song. My interest is in writing songs. And the best song communicates. So then my interest is in communication, but only secondly to the fact that I want to build a song that I'm proud of that moves. I mean, and any amount of fraudulence that is required to go into the song to make it as good as it can, I'm totally willing to do that. But I've just found it's easier, more reliable to stick with the truth, which is the way I look at life in general.
I was struck by how your memoir contains so much creative advice. And one of your observations that really stuck with me came from the Ben Folds 5 era. There was this quote you have, "We were learning that if something didn't make sense, it might be worth exploring because it meant nobody else was doing it."
Right.
Can you give me an example of how you, Robert, and Darren took advantage of that discovery?
Yeah. I mean, just the very fact that we were piano-based drums was one of them. And another thing was the distortion, not only of the bass, but the distortion of perspective that we depended upon. The background vocals needed to be as loud as the vocal, and the bass needed to give all that a good run for its money. The perspective that we required, and all music requires a perspective. You listen to Nat King Cole, and suddenly Nat King Cole was the quietest thing in the mix. It'd be very suspicious. If you got an engineer, and we're a baby band like we were, we tell the engineer, here's how we want to hear it. The engineer is going to say, well, that's ridiculous. It doesn't work that way. Oh, it doesn't, does it? Awesome. Maybe it does work that way then. We just came to feel that anything that got resistance was, you know, advance until apprehended is the way we felt. Even a band like Queen had broken a lot of rules, but did it in a way where you just really stressed the obvious. You know, you got a great singer, put that singer straight up front. Hell, overdub them, make 15 of them. Massive harmonies. Now, really exaggerate what they did. By the time we came along, you really needed to be looking at other things and exaggerating other things. You don't want to do what your parents did.
You mentioned a line from your song Phone in a Pool in your book, and the line is,
"Seems must be good for the music, hasn't always been so good for the life."
And I read in an interview that you wanted to reverse that lyric in the rest of your book.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that?
Yeah, because, well, there's a lot of different ways to look at it, and I don't know what I really believe. I felt at the time, the assumption was, when I wrote that line, was that a kamikaze lifestyle can result in some tragedy. But that kind of thought applied to art is often very useful. And, of course, the worst thing that could happen is that your song sucks. I think that was what I was thinking, was that the risk that I took in my art were being mirrored in my life, and it wasn't working for me in life. What I actually came to the conclusion after writing the book was that I was conflating a few things. I actually wasn't being kamikaze in my writing. I was actually just being brave and honest, which seems riskier than it is, because you have to take those risks. In my personal life, I was doing stunts, and I was also repeating mistakes over and over again. I was doing things that should have been seen to me as insane jumps off into the deep end that were unnecessary, and I'd already proven to myself that those things were not successful and make you sad.
Can you give me an example?
Well, I got married over and over again. Mm-hmm. That's a good one. So in the book, I was just kind of trying to, you know, show how one learns from the other, then the other learns from the other. Eventually, I started learning from my songwriting, because my songwriting was far more developed than my personality was, I thought. And I was able to go, well, what would my songwriting guy do? Well, he'd do that. Oh, I don't want to do that, you know. So in my real life, I'd have to do something I wasn't comfortable with, because that's what I would do in my songwriting.
Yeah. Do you think that there's a particular song that you've written that kind of embodies that shared sense of discovery that you mentioned?
Well, I think they all do if they're successful. It's a numbskull. It's kind of a pinheaded story. The song Brick is just simply a story. It's just a story of two kids, teenage abortion. It's a pretty heavy story, but, you know, at the very end, it gets to the point where it says, she's alone, and I'm alone, now I know it. When you hit that next chorus, it's a different chorus. You've now come to a different place. It's always a subtle thing. Like that's what makes it, that's what the art is.
Rocking the Suburbs is the title track from your 2001 debut album as a solo artist after leaving Ben Folds 5. What inspired you to write a song about the suburbs?
Well, I realized that there was a whole decade radio formats that were just dedicated 24/7 to white middle class anger. That's what that stuff was. Modern rock radio was white middle class anger. They were screaming all the time. Everything was bad. Everything was minor. Everything was loud, fuzzy, pissed off.
Let me tell y'all what it's like being male, middle class, and white. It's a bitch if you don't believe. Listen up to my new CD, Sham On.
You know, you took it for granted after a while. I wanted to poke fun of it, and as I thought about it, I was like, okay, I'm making fun of this, but there's something to it. I thought about Stevie Wonder growing up black and blind in a pretty rough time relative to civil rights. I think he had something to be pissed off about, but all his songs aren't angry. They're love songs, they're happy songs, all kinds of songs. So he'd actually been through it, so he could appreciate the good sides. And the middle class white guys that are so pissed off. Yeah, I know we're taxed a lot. Yeah, I know we work two or three jobs, and it is rough, and it's not nice to be taken for granted. I think the middle class is taken for granted. But still, I still don't quite get it. And I didn't get it. So you get a song written by someone who's kind of poking fun at it, who doesn't get it. And someone could say, yeah, well, you made it. Well, I was 27, I was waiting tables. I was an adult and was in debt and broke and poor, and I work hard now, and I get that. And I also get that as a white guy, there's things I can't say now. It's not our time, in a way. And I think that's awesome. I think, you know, everyone should have to be undeniable to succeed. And white guys have gotten a great shake, you know, for a long time. But while the anger, I don't know. And the song has no answers. I was just being absurd.
Mm-hmm.
And it could have been a lot more serious, I guess, if I'd written it with more wisdom.
Yeah. I want to ask you about what is probably my favorite Ben Folds song, Landed, which, of course, is from your second solo album, Songs for Silverman. It's very beautiful and poignant. And to my ears, I think it's the chord progression of the piano riff that it has kind of a country vibe to my ears. And I think those vocals are among your best vocals, especially the falsetto during the chorus. Can you tell me a bit about Landed?
Yeah, it came to me walking on the beach where I lived in Adelaide, Australia at the time. And I was thinking about my brother-in-law. And I really wrote it from what I thought was his perspective. It turns out it was from my perspective, as those things often discover them later on. But, you know, there was a time where he was working in a coal mine. So I can see that maybe if I wanted to connect with him, that I was connecting the music in a little more country sort of way. Then there's an interesting modal shift into the chorus. Suddenly the seventh scale degree is flat. It's just a different mode you wouldn't normally hear alongside the verse, which stays in the same key, but almost sounds like it's changed keys. Back to my lab coat, that's what, yeah, I was really drawn to. It sounded stormy suddenly, and it sounded like the footing of the tonality was being questioned for a second. And that to me seemed like a powerful place to put a story.
The subtitle of your book is A Life of Music and Cheap Lessons. What is the most valuable cheap lesson that you've learned in your life?
God, you know, they all are, because, mm-hmm, like, you might not look up to cross the street and have someone have to slam on brakes in front of you and scream at you. You know, oh, Jesus, I shouldn't be looking down at my cell phone while I'm crossing the street. I just was that guy. Told my kids not to do it, and then I did it myself. Man, I don't know. I can't remember that happened to me recently, but stuff like that happens all the time, and you're kind of like, okay, that's the most valuable one because I would end up dead. By nature, they're lessons that could things that could actually kill you.
Ben Folds 5 was loud, brutal music, as we were talking about earlier. Now you're frequently performing with orchestras. What is the difference for you between leading a three-piece band and now leading an orchestra?
Orchestra is like a big oil barge that is very difficult to turn around. Robert and Darren and I were more like a small race car where we could turn on a dime. Robert and Darren and I were more like a garage band where you communicate in very, very emphatic grunts. And you vocalize everything, make everything obvious in rehearsals. That wasn't good. Do that again. No, do it like this. J-j-j-j-j-j-j-j. 1, 2, 3. J-j. No. 1, 2, 3. It's like that. Orchestra is like, there's such a pecking order, not pecking order, such a protocol and such a lot of rules necessary to make it work. If you count off in rock music, you go 1, 2, 3, 4 and you start. Big band, a one, a two, and you start. Orchestra, and then you start. Or watch a baton go up. There's nothing to triangulate to so that you actually know what the groove is. I find it a big mystery. If something's not very good, they don't really speak to each other directly. It's you know, half of it's Italian. A lot of it is understood that it will land that night. Some of the things of the concert masters, Boeings and those issues. And there's a library involved. And so there's a huge difference. At the end of the day, it ends up being the same thing. But the way of getting there is, and I think orchestras could learn a lot. I mean, my work at the Kennedy Center with the National Symphony Orchestra, a lot of it is just about trying to bring some garage band wisdom into the symphony orchestra sometimes.
Ben Folds, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ben Folds is a singer, songwriter, and pianist. His memoir is A Dream About Lightning Bugs, A Life of Music and Cheap Lessons. Find out more about Ben at wpr.org/beta.
My biggest takeaway from this experience is that the Oscars gets a lot of stuff wrong.
Writer Shea Serrano on his cinematic thought experiments. That's coming up in a minute. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Have you ever wondered about which movie had the more intense opening? Face Off or Finding Nemo? Or what movie villain would you hang out with? If you have, then you're probably Shea Serrano. And if you are, thanks for listening, Shea. Shea is a staff writer for the sports and pop culture website The Ringer. He's also the author of Movies and Other Things, a collection of questions asked, answered, illustrated. It features a series of fun, innovative cinematic thought experiments, like would adding action superstar The Rock to a movie make it better or worse?
The intention here is you're going to take a very silly thing extremely seriously, first of all.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, we're talking about The Rock.
Mm-hmm.
We're just putting The Rock in the new movies. But it doesn't work if you're just doing it with no, like, underlying intention, no real reason. And in this case, what this very silly chapter is supposed to do, once you get past the veneer of it, is it's supposed to be some sort of commentary on The Rock creating for himself a sort of global stardom that doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
He was able to do it now when it just doesn't happen. It's not like in the 90s when Tom Hanks does a movie and then all of a sudden he's the biggest star in the world. It doesn't work like that right now. Everything's so fractured and segmented. But The Rock was able to do it. He was able to achieve that. And the way that he was able to do it is he just decided, you know what? I'm going to be in every single thing.
Yeah.
Everything you can think of, I'm going to be in it. So from 2016 to 2018, he's in 7 different movies
that
period.
Yeah.
And so the idea here is, like, he became a star. How did he do it? Okay, he did it this way. All right, cool. Let's sort of talk about that. And the way we're going to talk about it without talking about it is we're just going to put him in even more movies. We're going to go backwards, and we're going to put him in Titanic, and we're going to put him in P.S. I Love You, and we're going to put him in Predator, and we're going to put him in My Girl. And like, all right, well, like, if you're doing that, like, why are we doing it? Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
We'll figure out if it's a better, same, or worse with him in there.
Yeah, and you mentioned Titanic, which, of course, was directed by my fellow Canadian James Cameron. It's the 1997 blockbuster. So I'm guessing in this film that The Rock replaces Leonardo DiCaprio, correct?
That would be incorrect. In this case, we're replacing Rose. And in our new scenario, with The Rock as Rose, everything still happens exactly the same. The ship hits the iceberg, it goes down, but nobody dies because all of the passengers simply climb onto The Rock's back and he swims the rest of the way and everybody's safe.
Yeah.
And Rose is just so far from what The Rock is, like, ostensibly.
Right.
And you look at The Rock and he's like this giant, handsome, muscle man. Is like the opposite of what Rose's character is in the movie, which is this sort of debutante. So, you know, we'll do that. It'll just be more fun.
Right. So does this casting change make Titanic better, worse, or same?
It makes it so much better.
Yeah.
Because nobody dies.
Yeah, you exactly. Know, it's got an uplifting, happy ending. It's not a tragedy
now
anymore.
Now it's a great story.
Yeah, yeah.
I know it's a lot, the hair, the bod. When you're staring at a demigod, what can I say except you're welcome for the time.
You also created a gangster movie moment fictional draft, which serves as a ranking of your top 30 scenes from gangster films. What were the criteria you used to come up with your favorites?
Well, whenever you have a big conversation like this, you have to do some fence building here. Otherwise, everything's going to get away from you. So, for example, one of the rules that we set up ahead of time was, all right, you can only use the same movie twice. You can only, if you're going to pick a scene from a movie, you can't use that movie more than twice. And the reason we put this rule in place is because otherwise you're going to have 10 scenes from Goodfellas in the draft.
Yes.
And you don't want that.
No.
You know. Another one, the most controversial rule in this situation was, Robert De Niro is the greatest gangster movie actor that's ever been. You put him in a gangster movie, it's immediately better. He's just perfect in that capacity. So he's been in so many of them. He did Goodfellas and Casino and Once Upon a Time in America and The Untouchable. Like, there's a Bronx Tale. He's the guy.
Yeah.
And so even if you still have the rule in place where you can only use two scenes from a movie, you can still end up with like a very heavy De Niro draft.
Yeah.
You know, because how can you not have the baseball bat scene from The Untouchables?
Sunny day, stands are full of fans. What does he have to say? I'm going out there for myself. But I get nowhere unless the team wins.
Team.
The rule here is, much like when they made NBA Jam and Michael Jordan was not in it, in our draft, you can't pick any scene where De Niro is the main character.
That's great. Yeah. So was there one pick that you think is kind of like, because you did the top 30, right? The top 30 scenes or moments from gangster movies. Is there one that you think was your best pick and was kind of sort of off the grid and that something would be a little, people would be surprised by?
Well, yeah, I think we ended this one. The number one pick in this situation was we did a scene from a movie called The Bronx Tale.
Now you just can't leave.
I will never forget the look on their faces. All 8 of them. Their faces dropped. All their courage and strength was drained right from their bodies.
Bronx Tale is an underappreciated movie. It's lower stakes. It doesn't have this sort of world-chasing ambition that something like a Scarface does. It doesn't try to explain all of everything of like mafia life like The Godfather did. It just focuses in on one neighborhood and one group of people, and that was the scene there. And this is probably my favorite gangster movie, which is why I wrote the thing. I wanted to write about this one specific scene.
Yeah, it's also a very personal film to you, A Bronx Tale, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I watch it and I see a little bit of myself in there. I mean, there's some similarities to my life. Like, for example, the main character is a young kid named C. Mm-hmm. He grows up in this neighborhood, and on one side he's got Sonny, the like main gangster, trying to pull him in one direction. And then on the other side, he's got his father, played by Robert De Niro, of course.
Mm-hmm.
He plays like this noble bus driver trying to pull him in the other direction. And those are like the, you know, all of the movie's main themes are presented through these two characters. One guy's telling him one thing, the other guy's telling him another thing. Then one guy's telling him, you know, Mickey Mantle's not going to pay your rent. Why do you care about Mickey Mantle? The other guy is like going through baseball stats with him in this very earnest and sincere way. Not because of baseball is so important, but because he sees it as a way to, like, connect with his son.
Where's my money, Dad?
I left it in there.
What? How could you do that, Dad? It was my money.
That's bad money. I don't want you to have that money.
Dad, I earned that money.
I said I want you to stay away from him.
Dad, please listen to me.
I said you stay away from him.
Dad, listen to me!
Did you hear what I said? You stay away from him!
Sidney was right. The Wilker man is a sucker, Dad. He's a sucker.
He's wrong. It don't take much strength to pull a trigger, but try and get up every morning, day after day, and work for a living. Let's see him try that. Then we'll see who's the real tough guy. The working man is the tough guy. Your father's the tough guy.
But everybody loves him, just like everybody loves you on the bus. It's the same thing.
No, it's not the same. People don't love him. They fear him.
I have a very similar relationship with my father. Also, he's a bus driver. He's been doing it for 30-plus years in San Antonio, and it's just like, oh, these pieces sort of fit here. It touches me.
What, one of the most comprehensive things that you do in your book is to go through almost 25 years of movie history to reshuffle the Academy Awards and create what you call the brand new Academy Awards. You take some Oscars away from people and then give them to people who you think are more deserving recipients. Mm-hmm. What was your biggest takeaway from this experience?
My biggest takeaway from this experience is that the Oscars gets a lot of stuff wrong. Oh. I didn't start paying attention to the Oscars until like 2 or 3 years ago, really.
Yeah.
Like 1999 is one of the biggest years in cinema history, one of the most like influential and impactful. There's a great number of incredible movies that came out that year. So for the Academy Awards, you look at who won for them and you're like, what the heck was happening? Why did you not pick these other movies that, you know, 20 years later, it's so easy to see how important this movie was. So my main takeaway was that, like, even the people who are supposed to know more than everybody else screw up a whole bunch of times.
Yeah. It makes me think, 20 years later, maybe we need to incorporate time travel into the Oscars. Maybe we, you know what I mean, need to go 20 years in the future and then award films from, like, 1999.
So this guy, Bill Simmons, who I've worked for several years, he's great in these sorts of spaces, and he had this wonderful idea of we should give out the Oscars like several years after the fact.
Yes.
We're not going to do it right
exactly.
Then. We can wait a little while. And that's a
great idea. What was the what was the easiest decision to make in terms of the brand new Academy Award? What was the easiest one to decide, oh, I'm taking this person doesn't deserve it and this person really does deserve it? Can you point to an example?
A recent one is Green Book winning for Best Picture,
mm-hmm.
which is like, whoops,
yeah.
That should not have happened. that was one when they made that decision, everybody sort of in real time understood this was the wrong decision to make. The first line everybody drew was like, oh, this is Crash all over again, Crash winning for Best Picture. So something like that. Or Get Out, which I think is the like most important, most insightful movie that's been made over the last few years, not winning Best Picture. Like that's the first one I think of when Oscar tragedies that should be fixed immediately. That should be the one.
What is it that's so special about Get Out?
Get Out is one of those movies where you watch it and it's number one, it's just an incredibly made movie. It's well written, mm-hmm. it's well directed, it's well acted. There's not a part in there where you go like, oh, this movie would have been 5% better if they'd have done this other way.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also, this is very much talking about like the way America is working currently or has worked for the past however many years. And if you can make a movie that entertains you on like a number of different levels without really compromising any of the stuff it's trying to do, you should celebrate something like that. And Get Out, it was just so obvious from the moment it came out.
And I started putting
that it was
together.
Perfect.
And see, this is what I came up with. They're probably abducting black people, brainwashing them, and making them slaves, or sex slaves, not just regular slaves. But all I know is they already got two brothers we know, and it could be a whole bunch of brothers they got already. What's the next move?
Huh? And don't ever, ever say that I don't do nothing for you. Oh, white girl. Oh, they get you every time.
This was like a Shawshank in 1995. Like, oh, wow. Nobody saw this at the theater, and it had a big second life later on. But at the time, we sort of missed it. It's the same thing with Get Out. Like, we celebrated it a little bit, but not enough.
Yeah. Speaking of Shawshank, the Shawshank Redemption, you have a whole chapter about this, which you say that one of your favorite things to consider when you watch a movie is when there's a moment that you know happened in the film, but it happened off screen. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah. This was an idea that I had. A while back, I was rewatching this TV show called The Office. Are you familiar with The Office?
Yes, I am.
So at the end of season two, Pam and Jim, sort of lovers circling each other, but not really, they share a kiss. Jim mm-hmm. finally works up the nerve to kiss Pam. And that's the end of the season. And she's like, oh, you know, I can't do this. I'm going to marry this other guy. And then there you go. It's done. And I very much wanted to know what that next day at work looked like. Mm. Did Jim show up to work? Did he take a couple of days off? There was certainly some weirdness there. What was the first thing Pam said to him when they finally did talk? Like, I wanted to know about that. And that's that was the genesis of the idea. The same thing works here in movies. In Shawshank, for example, the warden arranges for like his main tough guy guard to shoot and kill another a prisoner, mm-hmm. a guy who like threatens whatever.
Yeah.
And so at some point, the warden had to have approached the guard, Hadley, and explained to him what he wanted him to do. And I would have I would like to know, like, how that went. Was the guard just like, all right, cool? Did the warden have to lean on him a little bit? What was the interplay here? I like to think about stuff that we know for certain happened in a movie. It's fun to imagine those scenes.
Yeah, and we just don't know how they happen. So yeah, that's great. I've got to start doing that more. In fact, I don't know if I've been doing it at all, but I'll have to go to school on what you're doing because it is such a great concept. Yeah, you also explore the concept of hanging out with a movie villain. Which mm-hmm. heavy would you most like to hang out with?
Oof, that depends on like what I'm trying to accomplish. But mm-hmm. if we're just talking about interesting people who I wouldn't mind being around.
Yeah,
I would like to hang out with Hannibal Lecter.
In fact, I found a very nice rendering of it here in the library the other day. If you like, perhaps I could sneak it out for you.
I would think that might jeopardize your chances for permanent appointment to the curatorship.
Only if you told.
I'm going to learn a bunch of stuff that I didn't know. He's going to teach me about some opera and some wine and like the way to cook a kind of meat. Like,
yeah,
because a guy explains it, Barney explains it, in the movie Hannibal, when the new Clarice character asks him, how did you survive around him all of these years? It wasn't just by being polite. And he's like, yes, that's exactly what it was. Oh. I just wasn't rude. He hates rude people.
Okay, yeah.
All right, I can be polite.
Sure, just be on your best behavior, yeah. Mm-hmm. We were wondering if you were a movie villain, what kind of a movie villain you would be. Perhaps you have a little bit of Patrick Bateman in you, a hint of Tyler Durden, maybe some Freddy Krueger. What do you think?
No, so this is the thing. When you have a movie villain, mm-hmm. a movie villain implicitly is cool. They're yeah. doing cool things. They're saying cool things.
And you're not
and
cool?
I have never been that in my life. Nobody has ever been like, man, Shay is cool. Everybody has been like, man, Shay is kind of funny sometimes. But nobody has been like, man, you know who he reminds me of? Tyler Durden from Fight Club. I'm not that at all. I'm like, best case scenario in that situation, I'm Robert Paulson. I'm a Meatloaf's character. Like I like want to hang out and I want to be involved, but like things are going to go wrong for me every time.
I think I don't know you well, obviously. I haven't had the chance to hang out with you, but based on what you write, your work, and just talking to you, you seem very cool.
Oh, the work, sure, the work is cool, but like in person, we're not going to be doing some cool stuff. We're going to be doing some very generic things.
Okay. So you have a very cinematic name, Shay Serrano. Would you keep that name if you were a movie villain, or would you go for something else, maybe like Shay Soze, Kaiser Serrano, or Ferris Durden, or something like that? What do you think?
Yeah, you need a harder a harder last name for me. Like you need it. You need a good, like I have two R's in my name, but yeah. I think you need like an R at the end of the name. The R is the most threatening letter. So I need that in there.
Shea Serranor? Serranor?
Like yeah, that? See, it just got worse. It just got worse.
Yeah. You write a bit about the 1997 biopic, Selena, in which Jennifer Lopez plays the music star Selena Quintanilla Perez. As a Mexican-American, is there any scene in this film that kind of captures your life experience?
There's one that does exactly that, and it's the whole reason they put it in there, and it's the whole reason... Not necessarily that this movie exists, but it's the whole reason that the movie feels the way that it does. And in this scene, Edward James Olmos is riding in the car. He plays Selena's father. And he's riding in a car in a van with Selena and with her brother. Selena's played by Jennifer Lopez. The brother is played by Jacob Vargas. And they're the brother and sister, they're trying to get the dad to like book them a gig in Mexico because the opportunity has come up. And he's like, well... This might not work out that great for you, and they're trying to figure out why, and he gets into this whole conversation about, like, being Mexican is different than being Mexican-American. Being Mexican-American means, like, you're caught in the middle.
Their homeland is on the other side of the ocean. Ours is right next door, right over there. And we got to prove to the Mexicans how Mexican we are, and we got to prove to the Americans how American we are. We got to be more Mexican than the Mexicans and more American than the Americans, both at the same time. It's exhausting. Man, nobody knows how tough it is to be a Mexican-American.
It's the best examination of the idea that has happened in a movie up to that point and since then. And we're talking, you know, over 20 years already. I don't think there's a better way to do it than the way that they did it, those three right there. Because you've got him, and he's being very serious and earnest in explaining this thing to them. Meanwhile, Jennifer Lopez and Jacob Vargas are, like, in a very, like, daughter-son sort of way, poking jokes at him and making fun of him. And he's trying to, like, impart some real knowledge, and they're not ready to hear it yet. And it's just all of the parts here are wonderful.
Shea Serrano, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me, man. It's always fun.
Shea Serrano is a staff writer for The Ringer and the author of Movies and Other Things, a collection of questions asked, answered, illustrated, featuring art by Arturo Torres. Find out more about Shea and the weird questions he asks himself about movies at wpr.org/beta.
I am not as disciplined as Abishala is. I'd say that's the biggest difference. She's also a bit more traditional than I am.
Actor Folake Olowofoyeku talks about the differences between her and the character she plays on the sitcom Bob Hart's Abishola. That's coming up on Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and you're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Since immigrating to the United States at the age of 18, Folake Olowofoyeku has made a name for herself in Hollywood. She's guest starred on such TV shows as 30 Rock, Modern Family, and Transparent. Now she's co-starring in the CBS sitcom Bob Hart's Abishola. The show was created by the Big Bang Theory's Chuck Lorre. Folake joins us to talk about her career and this new role.
Our show is a 30-minute comedy about Bob, a compression sock salesman who has a heart attack and during his recovery crosses paths with Abishola, a Nigerian immigrant nurse, and he takes an interest in her and moves about trying to pursue her. And a couple of our episodes will be focused on that.
Hi.
Oh, my God.
What, you can't take the bus?
Do whatever you want.
Come on. You can't tell me you didn't feel something special when you sang to me in the toilet.
You're a crazy man.
I must be. Getting on a bus, I don't know where it's going.
And then it takes a turn. I wouldn't say exactly what happens. You have to watch the show to find out. But we explore the immigrant experience. Specifically, we explore the Yoruba Nigerian immigrant experience in America, which also correlates and is also the universal immigrant story, I believe.
So where are you from?
Nigeria.
Wow. That's a heck of a commute, huh?
And Billy Gardell from Mike and Molly plays Bob, and you play Abishola. Can you tell me a bit about your character?
Yes, Abishola, like me, is a Nigerian immigrant of the Yoruba tribe. Unlike me, she has moved to America with her son for a better life for him. Specifically, she wants him to go to Ivy League school and become a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
That is the traditional Nigerian way. You're either a doctor or an engineer or a lawyer or, like Gina says, a failure.
Mm. And you say unlike me because you did immigrate to the U.S., but for different reasons, right?
I did, but for myself.
So what are the biggest differences between you and your character of Abishola?
Yeah, I think Falake, I am not as disciplined as Abishola is. I'd say that's the biggest difference.
Mm-hmm.
She's also a bit more traditional than I am,
mm-hmm.
which is not a bad thing. It's just who she is. At some point, I think I used to be more like that, and I grew out of it. Those are the two biggest differences. We probably have more in common than not, I think.
Who do you draw on to create the character of Abishola?
My mom, my aunties, the women that I grew up around in Nigeria. I draw from all of them, the mannerisms, all of that.
Have any of your relatives that you've based the character on, or any of them still around, have they had a chance to see any of the show yet?
A bunch of my aunties have seen the show. I can't say exactly what I get from whom. I just have created this library of information that has fed the character. A bunch of them are still alive, and they've seen it, and they're all very proud and wish my mom could see it and my father could see it as well.
Yeah, that would be nice. I understand that one of the writers on the show is Gina Yashir.
Yes, Yashir.
A British-Nigerian comic. Has Gina helped you to develop the character of Abishola in any way?
A lot of situations Abishola finds herself in, Gina has mentioned, is based on her real-life experiences.
Can you give me an example without spoiling the show?
Well, I'm assuming most people have seen the pilot by now. If I'm not mistaken, and you can't quote me by this, I'm just going off of memory, I think Gina said the scene with the principal was something she experienced.
Now, what was the unfortunate word your son said to my son?
That's not important. It's just trash talk.
Okay, I'll ask again. What trash did our son say?
I'm just going to write it down.
You're the youngest of 20 children, is that right?
Yes.
What was that like, growing up in such a large family and being at the bottom of the food chain, so to speak?
The food chain, right? A bunch of my siblings had already had kids of their own, some grandkids before I came into the picture. So they were most of them were out of the house. I grew up mostly with my brother before me, Balaji and Olumide before him. My eldest brother, I think, is in his mid-70s right now. And my dad would have been 100 and something.
Mm.
So they had all moved out by the time I came into the picture. And my brother before me and I, we didn't really get along. A lot of times I felt like an only child. And then apart from that, I was in boarding school from about 10 years old.
In 2001, you were 18 years old and you decided to emigrate to the U.S. You came to live with your sister. Was this your first time in the U.S.?
Yes, I didn't decide. I was just coming to see my sister on a holiday.
Oh, I see. Okay.
I just thought I was here on vacation, but something intuitively alerted me that it might be the start of a new chapter.
Mm-hmm.
What aided the transition was my results were stolen in Nigeria to get into university.
Oh, sometimes
really? Sometimes people steal it or give you the wrong information so you can pay them money to switch it and stuff like that.
Oh.
And when I found that out, I told my mom, this is impossible that I failed. I know I didn't fail, and if you're telling me to do it again, I'm never going to go to school. That's like the worst threat you can give a Nigerian parent. I'm not going to school. Like, I'm not going to school unless I can stay here in America.
You have 3 days suspension, during which you will do all your homework and clean the apartment from top to bottom. When you are finished, we'll find more homework for you to do. And I think you should join the track team.
Really?
Yes. One day you throw the chair at the wrong person. I need to run for your life.
Yeah, and when you started university here in the U.S., you were originally planning to study economics and become an attorney, right?
That wasn't my plan. That was my parents' plan.
Oh, I see. Okay.
But I did start. I think I took about a semester of economics. In A-levels in Nigeria, economics was one of my favorite subjects. I don't know that I did really well in it, but I enjoyed it. Hmm. I still do.
You've guest starred on many TV shows, including Westworld, Transparent, and Modern Family. Is there a particular TV guest starring role that you're most proud of?
I'd say Transparent. I'm very proud of the work on Transparent. I learned a lot outside of the show, delving into the research around my character and what she was experiencing in Palestine. That's my first time hearing about any of the conflict. So I'd heard about it in passing, but I'd never done any research into it. And I remember Jill Soloway and the producers had experts on the set who spoke to us about what was going on.
Yeah. Can you tell me a bit more about your character?
She was an activist in Palestine and became the love interest of one of the main characters for that season.
Do you want to get a drink? There's a bar in the hotel.
No, I try not to spend money in Israel. Because of the boycott?
Right.
Yeah. I try to do what I can for Palestinian justice.
Of course.
We can go to Ramallah. I know some really dope places there.
Go to Ramallah?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, here we go. Wait a minute. Am I allowed to just go to Ramallah?
Yeah. You are definitely allowed.
You play Afrobeat electronic music under the name The Folake. Can you tell me a bit about your music and why you make it?
Why do I make it? Because music is the love of my life. I keep touching it a little bit, you know, taking a step forward and then taking a couple of steps forwards because it's just so precious to me. But precious things should be shared. I'm self-taught in the guitar. Mm-hmm. I can play my own little something-something here and there. I don't call myself a musician, really, because I have so much respect for people who have dedicated years of their life to the craft.
Yeah,
I can't say that I'm a musician. Perhaps musically inclined, and I love it a lot. And I hope people will love it with me.
It's described as Afrobeat electronic music. Would you agree with that description?
I call it Afro-electric rock, if I have to call anything.
Okay.
Afro-electro-folk rock. Afro because the percussion is very important to me. That's what really gets me into the vibe, African percussion. And the talking drums, the congos, like just all African percussion. The bassier, the better. I am deeply into Slash. His riffs, his melodies are just so beautiful. And I like to incorporate that with African drums. And sometimes that manifests itself as a folk track or a pop-ish rock track. But the main elements are electric guitar and Afrobeat. And sometimes I just pull out the guitar and just rock with the percussion mostly.
Happy, happy, money don't come home. The money don't come, happy, happy, money don't come, oh. The money don't come, happy, happy, money don't come, oh. The money don't come, happy, happy, money don't come, oh. The money don't come.
Money don't land for accounts, money don't fool for the area, money don't land for accounts, money don't fool for the area, money.
It's a song that I worked with my producer in Nigeria. We're working on a bunch of tracks together. This song is going to be called Happy Happy, in parentheses, Money Don't Come. And it's just celebrating success while being reminded that materialism is not the goal, but love is the answer.
Love is the answer, love is the answer.
Good message there. I understand you're a big fan of the African-American science fiction author Octavia Butler, especially her 1980 book, Wild Seed.
I love that book.
Why do you love it so much?
I don't know why I love fantasy so much. I don't know. Maybe because I have a secret desire to be a superhero in real life. I just have superhuman abilities. There's just something so beautiful about Doro and his abilities and coming in contact with someone that he, in all his years, had never experienced. And her being able to just turn into fish and animals was just so beautiful. I guess there's some sort of freedom about it.
Falake Olowo Foyeku. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Falake Olowo Foyeku is one of the stars of the sitcom Bob Hart's Abishola. You can find out more about Falake at wpr.org/beta. That does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Ben Folds, Shea Serrano, and Falake Olowo Foyeku. If you want to hear it again or binge on past episodes, subscribe to the Beta podcast via iTunes or wherever you catch your favorite pods. And make sure to let us know what you think by leaving a rating or a comment. You can keep up with us during the week online at wpr.org/beta or on Twitter at @WPRBeta. Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
That's just flavor to a high life man.
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
Why not? George Clinton was a dog catcher.
Our executive producer, nay showrunner, is Adam Friedrich.
How the hell are you gonna get fired on your day off?
And thanks to you, our alphas. We'll see you next week. I'm Doug Gordon.
I'm trying to impress you, you know that.
I know it. Yeah. Now, where'd you get the mushroom shirt? I got to know.
Well, the secret is you got to coordinate.